the Omni Hotel in Washington, D.C., where we're getting ready for Congressional Education Day. You know, it used to be that the Jew Conference was a big deal, and then the November follow-up meeting was this kind of nice little quaint event. But as usual, you people don't seem to be satisfied to roll that way. So we've got over 500 people coming, over 400 appointments, 46 of 50 states representatives. We've got 34 state coordinators, 15 regional coordinators, 157 group leaders, 139 liaisons. And, you know, we continue to have more students come to these events. And just from Chapman College alone, they've got 10 students from that college alone. So we're here getting ready and hope to put on an extraordinary event here over the next few days. There's a very good chance you're calling from a new chapter, and I want to welcome you if you're one of the new chapters. So we added 13 chapters this month. That includes Vancouver, Washington, Fort Smith, Arkansas, Saddlebrook, Arizona, Springfield, Massachusetts, Wayne, Nebraska, Buffalo, New York, then a whole bunch in Texas. In Texas, Austin, West Central, Austin, Barton Springs, Grimes County, Houston, Briar Forest Memorial, Houston Heights, Houston, Rice Military, Houston, West University, Pearland, San Marcos, Southeast Austin, and in the UK, Edinburgh. And I want to especially say to Laura Morales and to our first group ever in the country of Colombia, welcome to you. One of the things we're excited about that is the Spanish website is now live. If you go up to our homepage and clip in the upper right-hand corner, you can choose English or Spanish to view our website. And now I'm going to completely bastardize the way I'm supposed to pronounce that website, but it's something like Clima Vive Ble. Let's just say that that's close enough. So what I'm going to be doing in just a moment is I'll be introducing our speaker, Major General Rick Devereaux from the Air Force. We're very excited to have. He'll make his initial statement, and then hopefully there'll be some time for some Q&A, which we'll pick up in the chat. After that, we'll go over some of the things that have happened since last month, talk about what's going to be happening this month. We're going to get a quick update on our year-end appeal from our brilliant development director, Lene Pettengill, and then I have something that I'm kind of excited to share with you at the very end of the call. So first of all, Major General Rick Devereaux, who served 34 years in the U.S. Air Force before retiring in 2012. His last assignment was Director of Operational Planning, Policy, and Strategy in Washington, D.C. He is currently Executive Vice President for the Government Affairs at Texon Technologies, a pioneer in the field of electromagnetic wave propagation, power storage, and electricity distribution, which sounds pretty exciting in addition to your remarkable Air Force career. So, Major General Devereaux, thank you so much for making yourself available on a Saturday. I know it's Veterans Day, so we're so thrilled to have a veteran, but we know that you had a talk that you already had to give downtown, and so you kind of had to rush back to make it work, and we're certainly pleased that you could, and welcome to our call.
Well, thank you very much, Mark, and welcome everybody out there. Happy Veterans Day to you. It's certainly an honor for me to talk about the topic of climate and national security on Veterans Day. I can't think of a more timely topic. So what I'd like to do today is just take a few minutes to discuss the intersection between climate, fossil fuels, and our national security. And I think I've got the background to do that. As Mark mentioned, my last job at the Pentagon was the director of operational planning for the Air Force. And in that role, we had to plan for all kinds of contingencies, whether it be contingencies related to conflict or, contingencies related to climate, whether it be humanitarian response to natural disasters or migration patterns that resulted in tensions or evacuations that had to be conducted. So I've got a background in this area from my military time frame. You know, one thing I like about CCL is their focus on bipartisan solutions. But sometimes, you know, you ask yourselves, well, how do you do that? How do you forge a consensus on a controversial topic like climate change? Well, I think one way is to outreach to folks that normally wouldn't be part of that conversation. And that's conservatives, folks interested in national security. So I think this is a good way to sort of forge a broader consensus when we talk about climate and its impacts. So I want to briefly today, in my opening remarks here, give you a few caveats first off in terms of things you should be aware of when you're talking about climate, national security, then give you about four talking points that I think work in this realm. And then finally conclude with just an example of a event that we did in Asheville, North Carolina, where we were able to attract quite a broad group of folks to talk about climate and national security. So first off, some of the caveats of this topic. First and foremost, you know, the military is really not interested in entering the debate on human-caused climate change. So be careful as you talk about this topic, implying that the military wants to weigh in on human-caused climate change. Number two, the military is probably also not interested in taking the lead in solving global climate change. You'll hear a lot about green initiatives and things along those lines, but there again, the national security focus isn't in solving climate change for the sake of it. They want to be good stewards of the environment, but fixing climate change is not their mission. Also, be careful about overstating or exaggerating the relationship between climate change and national security. I'm going to talk about the linkage, but don't overstate it. And finally, when you talk about this topic, it's always good to use expert opinion, military sources, national security experts. I would lean more heavily on that group than, say, an environmentalist organization. And be aware that there's going to be skeptics as you get into this topic on both sides of the debate. Conservatives will say, are you rolling in a Trojan horse? Are you trying to attract me by talking about national security in a topic that I think you're going to do a bait and switch and maybe change this to an environmentalist pitch? And in some cases, environmentalists on the left will say, what are you bringing the military into this discussion? We all know they're the worst offenders when it comes to environmental issues. So be aware of that skepticism on both sides. So now let me give you a few talking points. Talking point number one, the military is planning for climate change. They believe it's real. In fact, the Department of Defense was directed in the 2018 National Defense Authorization Act, which was passed by the Congress, that with this directive, that climate change is a direct threat to the national security of the United States and is impacting stability in areas of the world, both where the United States Armed Forces are operating today and where strategic implications for future conflict exist. So the Department of Defense must ensure that it is prepared to conduct operations both today and in the future, and that it is prepared to address the effects of a changing climate. The military installations must be able to effectively prepare to mitigate climate damage in their master planning. So in other words, the combatant commanders all around the world have been directed to make sure they incorporate the impacts of climate change into their planning process. And one area where that's very tangible is installations that are near coastlines. The Department of Defense says that there's about 704 coastal installations. One recent report says 128 of those are at risk from sea level rise. So there's a lot of planning and mitigating actions that are taking place with respect to installations near coastlines. And then, of course, the big area of planning is what I'll call accelerants of conflict. These climate change factors that tend to aggravate bad situations around the globe, leading to drought, famine, migration, coastal flooding, instabilities that arise within governments because of those kinds of things. And as a result, the military gets called to act. So combatant commanders around the globe are planning for these types of events. In fact, here in Asheville, North Carolina, there's an active duty Air Force weather squadron called the 14th Weather Squadron. They're the climatological database for the entire Department of Defense. And in part of their mission is to really predict where climate change impacts around the world are going to result in the need for military forces. So military is not in denial. They're front and center. But not only for talking point number two, not only are they planning for climate change, at the same time, the military is moving away from fossil fuels. Our current Secretary of Defense in the Trump administration, Secretary of Defense James Mattis, has said that our military has to, and I quote, be unleashed from the tether of fuel. Why? Not because necessarily of its impact on climate, but for three reasons. One, fossil fuel dependence is a conflict driver. It can be a source of international conflict and tension. The military likes to deter conflict. They don't like to be used in conflict. And if you look at the last 30 years in the Mideast, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that fossil fuel dependence has resulted in lots of conflict, lots of deployment of U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf region, in Iraq, even Afghanistan. Trillions of dollars spent, lots of blood and treasure. Also, if you look at the strategic choke points around the world, places like the Straits of Hormuz, the Suez Canal, the Malaccan Straits, 60% of the world's seaboard oil passes through these straits, and the U.S. Navy is charged with keeping those sea lanes open. It's an expensive proposition and a dangerous proposition, as we've seen most recently with the collision of the USS John McCain with what? An oil tanker, leading to the unfortunate loss of life. So this is linkage to sea lanes and strategic choke points is a big driver of the DoD budget and a potential source of conflict. The third talking point and why the military is sort of reducing its dependence on fossil fuels is that fossil fuel dependence limits warfighting effectiveness. It creates a huge logistical burden and a point of vulnerability. You know, most people realize that the military is very dependent on fossil fuels for aircraft, vehicles, powering generators at forward bases. And this is expensive and costly, not just in terms of money, but in terms of lives. About a third of the casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan came from convoys and supply lines. In fact, one out of every 24 convoys in Afghanistan resulted in a casualty. So that's the reason why there's a big push for green, renewable sources so that we can sort of wean our dependence off these vulnerable supply lines. And finally, the final talking point of why the military is trying to go more green and more towards sustainable fuels is because fossil fuel is expensive. The DOD, the Department of Defense, accounts for 93% of the U.S. government's energy usage. The Air Force alone burns 55% of the federal government's energy bill. The Department of Defense consumes 360,000 barrels of oil every day. That's every day. You heard me right. I used to fly air refueling aircraft. Because of the expense of that fuel and the operations, we really pay $42 a gallon for gas that we pass in the air. The convoys in Afghanistan, when you figure out all the security costs and so forth, we were paying $400 a gallon for fuel that we moved in Afghanistan. So the DoD is pressing hard on conservation, efficiency, and getting the cost down via renewables. So I'm going to stop right there. I was going to maybe in the question and answer period when we talk about what we can do, I'd like to share an example of what we did locally in Asheville on this topic. But I'll let that hopefully come out in the questions and remarks. So let me just stop there with those four talking points.
Okay, that was fantastic, Rick. And I do hope we can get to the local comment also. We should have time. We'll open up the questions in the chat in just a moment. I have one very specific question about one particular member of Congress. I'm not going to say who it is, but when the local chapter goes in and meets with him and talks about this and says, you know, the last quadrennial defense review said that climate change is a potential threat multiplier, doesn't cause threats, but could exacerbate it. And his pushback is, well, that was written under the Obama administration, so it's biased. It just doesn't seem to me that something coming from the military could be tainted by political bias. And is there something that you could recommend she could say back to that particular member?
Yeah, Mark, that's a great question. You know, I my last Pentagon tour was during the Obama administration, and I would grant that in the first few years of the administration, there was a lot of pressure on the Department of Defense to, what I'll say, go green for green's sake. And there was some resistance. But after that pump was primed, military leaders at the installation level all the way up to the strategic level started to realize the inherent military operational advantages of moving towards more sustainable fuels. And so I was just in the Pentagon, in fact, this week on Tuesday, and I asked this very question. I said, now that the Trump administration is in charge, what are you guys doing differently in this area? And the answer is nothing, because we realize, for instance, that in order to make, say, our bases more resilient, we have to disconnect ourselves or be less dependent on the civilian electrical power grid. How do we do that? By putting wind farms and solar panels on our bases. Going renewable makes us more resilient. Therefore, even if the administration says no more green for green's sake, it doesn't matter because from a military utility standpoint, these initiatives make sense. So that would be my answer. And talk to the folks that are leading troops and setting policy in the Pentagon, even without all the political appointments in place, they're full steam ahead on staying with sustainables.
Okay, well, the first question in the chat came in specifically about a specific member of Congress again. And the question is, do you know Air Force General Don Bacon, who is now our representative in Congress? Could you please talk with him?
I know Bits Bacon well, and I will be happy to talk with him. Yeah, I'll track him down.
So then the next question in the chat is, thank you for that, by the way, and that should make that chapter very happy. You mentioned the military uses 360,000 barrels of oil every day. Has the number reduced over the years?
It has. I will say that during the Obama administration, there was a big impetus on conservation and being more efficient. And again, part of the initial push may have been for climate-related reasons, but the military got on board for one simple reason. The more they can decrease their dependence, the more one, budget they have left for other things, and two, they can run operations more efficiently with less sort of dependence on long supply lines and so forth. So there has been a reduction. I don't have the exact figure, but I want to say somewhere in the range of about 15% reduction over the last 10 years. And that's in a period of lots of conflict and lots of operations.
Great. Okay, boy, they're coming in fast and furious now. Hold on a second. I'm going to scroll up a little bit here. Is there an estimate of how much money we've spent protecting the sea supply line?
Well, it's hard to get those kinds of estimates because there's so many factors that come into play. But I can answer it a couple different ways. One, let me go back to my meetings in the Pentagon this week. I met with one gentleman from the Office of the Secretary of Defense for installation energy. And the figure I got quoted is that in some cases, they're spending not $400 a gallon, but upwards of $1,000 a gallon to put diesel in generators in deployed locations because all the cost of moving that fuel and protecting it and so forth and paying a premium price sometimes overseas. So it's a big factor. And of course, we know the cost of energy that we pay at the pump in some senses subsidize. You know, when you think about this, like for instance, the strategic choke point issue, in order to get gasoline at $2.50 a gallon, that assumes the free flow of those resources through places like the Straits of Hormuz or the Malaccan Straits. And that's the U.S. Navy essentially subsidizing that cheap oil price.
Yeah, there's several questions have come up about the Arctic and with, reduced ice flows. How is the military viewing that at this point?
Great question. That comes under that talking point of the military is planning for climate change. Good friend of mine is a four-star general in the Air Force who's the commander of Air Mobility Command, which owns all of the strategic airlift and air refueling aircraft. He just got back from a visit to Greenland and Iceland. Him and his fellow four-star generals were up there sort of on a survey trip, getting briefings on how the Arctic is changing and what that means for air, land, and sea operations in terms of increased U.S. military presence, competition for resources, and increased commercial presence in that region. So again, the military is kind of agnostic as to why this is happening, but they know they have to react and respond to it, and there's a big bill associated with that.
Yeah, it seemed not that long ago there seemed to be more of a push towards biofuels for military airline. Is that still coming along, or where is it that at this point?
Yeah, we did a lot of testing with biofuels probably 8 to 10 years ago. There were some high-profile missions involving like B-52s that were flying on global missions, all on biofuels, other aircraft. Those were generally conducted to make sure the concept was doable from a technical standpoint. But I think there's a realization that the cost of producing the quantities of biofuels to make that significant chunk of the DoD fuel requirement would be very high. But the idea was, let's make sure we can demonstrate it so that in areas that we do have access and it's a real possibility, we know we can do it.
Cool. One question also was, given the quantity of user of fossil fuels that the military is, do you think that there would be some pushback about carbon fee dividend, given that it would cause their cost to go up?
Wow, that's a good question. I hadn't thought about that.
Neither had I.
And I think that's a really good point, and one that we need to think deeply about. What is the right answer to that? Is there some sort of national security exemption or a transition period for critical sort of requirements out there? But that, I think, whoever generated, I don't have a good answer, but it's one that we need to think about.
Yeah, I think we have, 50 or 60, we call the quote laser talks now. Every one of them came from a question that didn't have a ready answer with. So we always appreciate it when we get these questions. So we go, good, another thing we need to go to work on. Would you mind sharing with us an example from Asheville that you were referring to earlier?
Yeah. I think this was really exciting. And it was the way really that I got engaged with CCL. You know, I'm interested, obviously, in this topic of climate, fossil fuels, and national security. And we talked in our local chapter that, boy, if we could do an event on this topic, it might be a way to draw conservatives, liberals, veterans, progressives, the whole sort of panoply of folks that ordinarily wouldn't talk about climate change in the same room together. So we took the movie The Burden, which was a 2016 documentary by Roger Sorkin, a very good film that sort of covered many of the points that I just made in my intro. You know, everybody likes movies. A movie is an easy thing to promote. So we found a local brewery, Highland Brewing Company. And in fact, we used the venue as a way to sort of convince this brewery to sign our leader letter because they got interested in not just the topic, but our organization. We heavily promoted it among veterans groups, among, I went on a conservative radio talk show and promoted the event. And we had a great turnout by, again, it looked like a Star Wars bar scene. A lot of folks sort of talking about climate that normally wouldn't. We showed the film, and afterwards we had a panel discussion. And there were three of us on the panel, myself, another retired military officer who had climate expertise, and then our local chapter leader, Steffi Rouse, who talked about solutions in CCL. And we had a great turnout, about 200 people, great coverage in the media. And it just, I think it was a model for maybe how to gain an entry into a group that normally wouldn't be interested in this topic. And I had so many testimonials afterwards where people came up to me and said, well, in fact, one guy said, I've never met an environmentalist until today. And I realized they're not bad people. That was a veteran that said that. I think it was a good model.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you so much. I think this is going to be extremely useful for our membership. We're not interested in winning arguments. We're interested in solving problems. So we're always looking not just for the information, but kind of the practical application. I think you provided a big dose of both today. You're certainly welcome to stay on for the next 10 minutes if you like. But I know it's Veterans Day, and there's other things you have planned. But either way, thank you so much. This was very, very useful for us, and we very much appreciate it, and we appreciate your service to our country also.
Well, thank you, Mark. My pleasure to be here today.
All right, great. Thank you so much. Okay, I'm going to bring on Lene Pettengill in just a moment, our development director. I want to just mention a couple of things quickly before that. We've had a lot of really big, successful regional conferences around the country. But in the spring, in addition to that, we had another national conference in Ottawa in Canada, where 44 of 49 of the meetings were face-to-face. Absolutely extraordinary in Canada, where it seems like meeting session after session, almost all the meetings end up being face-to-face. I also just want to shout out to Albuquerque, because for 6 years, the chapter in Albuquerque, Lisa Silva and everybody there, kept reaching out to the newspaper there, and it took 6 years before we finally got an op-ed with a major headline in the paper. And I just want to say how much I appreciate that kind of perseverance and hanging in there when, there was just no response. And then lastly, I just want to mention in the endorsements, there were 7 municipal resolutions, 5 state representatives, 1 state senator, 2 mayors, and 4 breweries, all from Asheville, Rick. I signed endorsements this month. So probably your event had something to do with that. Yep. Okay, good. So, Lene, I think there's some big, exciting things happening with our year-end appeal. I suspect you're somewhere in the same hotel that I am. Can you unmute your line for a second?
Yeah, just wave to you from the first floor. So this year we have a $600,000 matching gift pool as part of our year-end appeal. And this was created by 60 donors whom we refer to as Women Who Will and Generous Gentlemen. They've each pledged to give $10,000 in support of our climate solution work. So this appeal launches Giving Tuesday, which is November 28th. And runs through the end of the year. So whenever you make a donation in that window, it will be matched dollar for dollar. You'll be receiving a letter in the mail about this towards the end of the month, and then a couple of emails as well. So I'm both excited about this and a tad bit terrified. $600,000 is a huge number. Last year, our matching gift pool was $250,000, so a really big jump up. But I've learned to have faith in the mighty CCL volunteer. I bet we're going to make this aggressive goal. And to help us make this goal, this is the one time a year that we ask you to reach out to family and friends to see if they might be interested in donating to our work. Work which you've probably already told them quite a lot about. The fact that their donation will be immediately doubled should be a great motivator for them. And then also, hopefully, it'll make it easier for you to make that ask. There are more details on your action sheet, including some sample text you can use. Thank you so much for any contribution you can make and for reaching out to others. Okay, fingers crossed.
Thank you, LeVay. Appreciate that.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, so I want to go over the Canadian and U.S. actions, and I have one last thing I want to discuss with you quickly. In Canada, we're working on the CCL Canada 50 Club and also asking your city to sign on to the open letter like Toronto did last month. So I like what we've put together also on the U.S. action sheet. The first thing it says, develop the first part of your chapter's bill introduction action plan. For the last couple of years, and really intensely over about the last year and a half, we've been working very hard on, are we ready the moment a bill drops? Now, does this say a bill's dropping next week? I don't think so. I'd be pleasantly surprised if it did. But what we've said to ourselves is we need to work every day to be ready so that we're responding, not reacting to what's happening. But we've done that almost exclusively as a staff. So what we thought is, well, that's silly. We should extend the same process to the chapters. And so over the next 3 months, what we're going to be asking you to do is doing actions to prepare yourself. So the minute a bill drops, you're ready to get into action. You've already laid out what you're going to be doing. So we thought it would be good to expand that to include not just the staff, but the volunteers. And I like how it's laid out over the next 3 months. The second thing refers to what Lene just reported on, which is getting ready for Giving Tuesday. You know, make sure you're thinking about the day on Giving Tuesday. What are you going to do? Have things organized. Put something in your calendar already to prompt the people that you want to be reaching out to. And then there's two really, really good communication exercises that I recommend that you do both. Okay, last thing is this. So last year, a lot of us made a very big promise. And if you're new to Citizen Climate Lobby, I and a bunch of other people promised that we would get legislation passed this year. And if we looked at what's predictable between now and the end of the year, it's probably more likely that we don't keep our promise than we do. We still can. It's just, you know, it's not predictable that we will keep it. So I think there's a couple of things that we should ask ourselves if let's say that we don't keep the promise. A, did it make us a better organization for having made the promise? And I think you can unequivocally say yes. Really, what drove the process that we've been working on to get ready for a bill pass was in the background of that promise. Now, we've always been an organization that makes big promises. So for the last 8 years, we've promised to double the size of the organization every year, and we've kept that promise. And when we add 2,000 more supporters this year, we usually add about 10,000 a month, we will have doubled again from last year. Now, 3 years ago, we promised to have a group in every single in every single congressional district in the country, and we fell short, but we had a supporter by the end of the year. So we felt like that promise also empowered us. So the last thing I want to say to you is this. If we don't keep our promise, if you think we as an organization will stop making big promises, you are sadly mistaken. This is how we roll. This is part of CCL's DNA. We make big promises. We put our butt out as far on the line as we possibly can, and then we see how things roll out. All right, everybody, thank you all so much. I'll see those of you who will be in D.C. in the next few days. For those of you who are not, we'll be getting the full report. Ricky, you want to unmute everybody so we can thank Major General Devereaux again. Thanks again.
Bye.
Yeah.
Back in D.C. Unmute the line. Thank you, bye.
Sorry. I know.
Yeah, it'll be up.
Hey. Oh, God. Hey, Kate.